ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're the Prime Minister. What's your first move? Make Australia a green energy superpower. Fix the housing crisis. Treat mental health as a national priority. The economy, stupid, is talking about what Australia could become if we had the courage to choose it. Search for The Economy Stupid and look out for Choose Your Own Australia. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and the ABC Listen app.
Hello there, welcome to the Best of the Minefield from 2025 on RN Summer. Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, or whatever time of year it is exactly that you're listening to this. Wonderful to have you with us. Waleed Ali is my name, Scott Stevens is my co-host. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Waleed. This is a good one. We realise that all sorts of people are up to all sorts of things, and so we wanted to give them an episode that we found challenging, but that also, I don't know, caters to the spirit of the season. We are used to receiving bad taste gifts, right? We're used to indulging in some fairly bad taste conversation, and maybe you've just put a whole lot of stuff in your mouth that just tasted bad. Well, we did want to bring you one of our favorite episodes of the year, where we talked about taste and whether taste itself is beginning to atrophy because we no longer have to be as discriminating as we once were.
Is this another AI conversation?
It's not quite an AI conversation, but we're having an awful lot of stuff served up to us so we don't have to choose for ourselves.
I do understand that, although I think one of the phrases of the year was AI-generated slop. Anyway, one of the best bits of radio, I think, is not the show coming up. It's just Scott's introduction to the show just then. That was amazing. However, the second best bit might be the show that's coming up. We hope you enjoy.
Can we really nerd out here and just call it the phenomenology of online life?
So, it's nowhere near as nerdy as I thought.
So there are all sorts of things that work in a certain way. On this kind of show, we don't have much of any interest, I think, in the machinery behind why things work the way that they do, what it is that makes recommendation algorithms work, why it is that certain types of content perform the way that they do, what's the algebra of virality. We don't really have much interest, I think, in why the machinery works the way that it works, partly because we're not computer scientists or programmers or coders. But for those who live in an online world, for those of us who increasingly engage with the world through the mediation of these little screens and the platforms and programs that populate them, what is it about the way that these things do that influence the way that we live, how we consume certain material, how we interact with the outside world? So the phenomenology of online culture is, what are the things that present themselves to us and impose themselves then upon our subjectivity, on our experience of engaging with the world through these screens? And I think it's pretty safe to say that there is no single mechanism that more influences, determines, directs, and mediates that mediation than the entire universe, the thicket, let's call it, of algorithmic recommendations. And one of the reasons why algorithmic recommendations or recommendation algorithms are necessary is because we now live in an age, Waleed, of infinitely reproduced digital content. We have long since left behind the idea of cultural scarcity, that I don't have enough at my fingertips, that I don't have another book or another album on the shelf. If I don't like something, I don't have to wade or muscle through it. If I don't like something, I can simply go to the next, or I can even do that option that says, don't recommend anything more like this. So when you've left the conditions of cultural scarcity behind, there are only a certain number of movies to watch, only a certain number of DVDs or VHSs. I was introducing one of my sons to a VHS the other day. When the materiality of those things has been left behind, and suddenly you have streaming services with hundreds, if not thousands, of options. When you have streaming services with tens of thousands, if not millions, of possible songs. Algorithms are the way that we negotiate our way, we navigate our way through that thicket of infinite digital reproduction. They become our guiding light. Hence the, if you like this, here are the other options along the same vein that you may well like. But with that network of recommendations, comes a certain mortal danger to the capacity.
Oh, wow, you really raised the stakes there.
Well, to the capacity of cultivating both the sense of what it is we do like, but also the ability to articulate why it is we like what we like. And I do think that when we talk about something like taste, that's what we're talking about. A sense of what it is we like, but also the ability to articulate, this is why we like what we like.
Okay, I'm intrigued by your argument. I'm even attracted to it. But I want you to say more about it. I want you to join the dots here. Why is it that having things recommended to you by an algorithm as opposed to by a friend or, I don't know, a broadcaster or a reviewer in a newspaper or something like that deprives you or blunts your the keenness of your taste in a way that the old forms didn't?
I think that's a perfectly wonderful question. So once upon a time, when we were still in this age of digital culture, but before algorithmic recommendations hadn't yet kind of taken over the ecosystem, there was still that wonderful process of, for want of a better term, curation, where trusted persons, you could call them editors of a particular site, you could call them reviewers, you could call them critics, sorted through, and you know, to some extent we still have this in the form of newsletters and maybe even Substacks. But someone would go through and
and just social media videos.
Okay, sure. Where someone would go through, this is all the stuff that's out there. This is the stuff that I've found useful. I think you might find it useful too. And what allows that particular relationship between the person who receives that review or the person who receives that email, the thing that binds us together is the sense, I like this person's taste in things, or I've come to trust this person's judgment. Let me give you an example. One of my favorite film reviewers from about, I mean, he's still reviewing, but I really, really, really liked what he was doing about 15 years ago. Peter Bradshaw, he worked then for The Guardian. I think he probably still does. I remember reading this little, it wasn't even quite a review yet. It was this little snippet in the middle of a kind of rounding up of various things that he had recently watched at the movies. And he made reference to a 2006 film by Alfonso Cuarón called Children of Men. It's a kind of adaptation of a novel that I love by P.D. James, but taking that novel and doing something radically different with it, aesthetically different. And he said, it's the type of movie, I mean, it is dystopian. He said, it's the type of movie where I left the cinema, I wanted to grab someone by the collar and say, what are you doing? You've got to go and watch this. And for someone like Peter Bradshaw, who is, you know, a little bit more kind of restrained in his style of film review, it really struck me. It struck me as a rare moment of kind of unbridled enthusiasm, if we can call it that. But because I'd come to trust his judgment, because his sense about what makes certain films great seemed to align with the sort of films that I also found great, there was something about that exuberance that I couldn't help but take seriously. But I think, Waleed, there's not just that moment of trust between us and the person who's doing the recommending, but this is what I think a really excellent critic does. A great critic, a great curator, a great connoisseur of culture doesn't just tell you what's good and what's bad. They also do something to teach you, this is the value that I saw in that. This is why this album captivated my attention. This is why, even though after the first listen, it didn't grab me, after two or three, this is what was going on beneath the surface. These that are, okay. are the resonances
yes,
that
I understand heard. That point. I could see a counter-argument, though, that goes, well, actually, what's happening there is you're merely outsourcing your taste. You're not even cultivating your ability to determine for yourself why something is something that you like, but you're going into that thing already having prejudged it according to criteria that are laid out for you by someone else, that actually there's less work for you to do in determining your response to things or developing your palate. That in some ways, the bold recommendation that an algorithm provides, oh my God, I can't believe I'm making this case. Anyway, that at least is leaving it in your hands to judge whether or not it actually is up to the mark. In part because you know that it's a machine that's spitting things out and that there might be something crude about that recommendation. I guess that depends on the level of trust you have in machines and algorithms and, you know, mathematical formulae over human intuition and recommendation. But you must know that experience, Scott, of you read a review and then you go watch the film or the play or read the book or whatever, and you go in it with the attitude of, well, I guess I have to like this.
Mm, it's true.
And I have to like it for these reasons.
Yep.
And it's all been framed for me ahead of time. And then you can occasionally get that really strange feeling where, but I didn't like it, or, but everyone says this is rubbish and I thought it was actually quite good. The response to that internally, at least as far as I'm concerned, is not, well, look at me forming my own independent tastes. My feeling is, oh, I guess I got that wrong. So there's a level of outsourcing there.
That's,
I don't know. I just think there's a sneaky argument there that
it's
could
true.
Be made that what's happening there is not the cultivation of taste rather than it's outsourcing.
Look, up to this point in the argument, I think that's perfectly fair. And I think one of the things that then raises is the extent to which taste is not just an internal thing. It's not just something that we possess individually, but taste is also in a kind of constant dialogue with the criteria, with the standards of tastefulness in the prevailing culture. Here's where taste intersects, say, with class. If you have a refined palate, you will enjoy this. If you don't enjoy this, it's because there's something wrong with your aesthetic or your culinary palate. And then that raises the other issue, which I think is really kind of interesting always to me. At what point are you permitted to have really, really bad taste? This is something that Pierre Bourdieu, I think, has both analyzed and also captured in a moment of characteristic subtlety. He suggested that it's only when one ascends to a particular hierarchy within culture that you can then ironically delve into those lower recesses.
But again, so when it becomes a guilty pleasure rather than a naively bad pleasure.
Or, okay, I enjoy Krzysztof Kieslowski's Polish and French films, but I also like to slum it in a little bit of kind of late 1970s exploitation B flicks. You know, there's something about that yes, I've got that sophistication, but I also don't mind schlepping with the common folk. So there's something.
Yeah, you see this in people who will devour reality television, for example.
Exactly right.
It was quite a big thing, actually. I remember when The Bachelor was around. Remember?
I do.
That, and you'd have all these people who would identify very firmly and quite articulately as feminists and then get together and have bachelor parties, as in to watch the show. And that was exactly the way that was kind of rationalized or spoken about. Mm. Okay, well, this is the guilty pleasure and I do it in a knowing sort of a way.
But it's also upper middle class transgressivism, which is
I don't know if you can be transgressive when you're watching a...
Of course you can.
Big commercial format. But
anyway,
oh,
yes, you can.
Okay.
Okay, but here's the main point, I think, for me, Waleed. Taste, obviously, is something that is singular. It is peculiar to the person. Why it is that you like the particular mix of novels, movies, music, foods, say. Why it is you like that particular mix is partly inherited. You would have learned it from someone else. It's partly incredibly individual and biographical. I had a wonderful experience with this, and therefore it'll always have a special place in my heart. Sometimes it's also inexplicable in the sense I just like it. I don't know exactly why, but I simply like it. And then some of it's also performative. It is one of the expectations upon me that this would be the kind of thing that I should like. And then with that performativity also goes a degree of shame. It's also expected of me that I wouldn't like, or I could never publicly admit. So you have that particular kind of thicket of things that work together to produce the sense of taste as something that is partly given, that is partly performed. But I think the other thing that really interests me about taste, Waleed, is the extent to which taste can be something that is individual, that is singular, that is peculiar. But by becoming more literate, more articulate in why it is we like, what is it that I'm tasting there? What is it that I'm sensing there? What is it? So in your example of something that you are supposed to like, but you didn't, in fact, there might be a degree of cultural shame that goes with that. Or the first question might be, what was I missing? And if you've satisfied yourself that there wasn't actually something, I mean, this is the disagreement you and I had from the very beginning about the film Oppenheimer. I just don't see it. And I've rewatched it, and I've rewatched it, and I just don't see it. And the more I watch it, the more I hate the film. But I think in the interim, I've become more articulate about why it is that I dislike the film. There's the flip side of that, which is there is something that I can feel that I like about this. And by becoming more aware of what it is about this object and what it is about me that resonates with that object, one then reaches that next stage, I think, of taste, which is, and I wonder what you think about this, there's one's own enjoyment, and then there's the Peter Bradshaw moment. I just saw this film. I want to grab someone and share that experience with them.
So the intensity of recommendation.
The intensity of recommendation, but also one of the things that goes along with becoming articulate about why one likes what one likes, why one loves what one loves, is the desire to persuade someone else, this is why I love that. It would make me the happiest person alive for you to come and enjoy it too. I recently reread something. I've been trying to persuade my wife for 4 weeks now. Can you please read this so we can talk about it together? Can you please share with me in my enjoyment of this? Because there's something about taste where it's not simply performed for one's class or performed for one's cultural expectations, but where it's genuinely shared. Yes, it's peculiar to me, but this thing that I've come to love approaches the beautiful. And because it's approaching the beautiful, it ought to be something that is available to all. Now, just before...
And by that process, you find your people. That's part of what's going on there. And
yeah,
I think this is elemental to human beings because we do preserve it, right? We have exactly this phenomenon in... they're constantly recommending to each other shows in a fractured television environment where no one's really watching the same thing. It all has to work via recommendation. So you can no longer talk about a show because there'll be spoilers and people haven't watched. You have to first establish that you're allowed to talk about a show. But in the act of recommending, and then the thrill when someone takes your recommendation and comes back to you and shares your enthusiasm for it, that's all still there, and that's all stuff that we are trying to do, that we are trying to preserve because that's how we interact. That we do need to share cultural artifacts in order for them to not necessarily have any meaning, but to have the full weight of their meaning. So that I accept. But is the argument then that there can be no algorithmic substitution for that? That there is something that has to be fully human in that process? Or are you merely saying that the way in which algorithmic recommendation works is, at the very least at this point, anemic?
That's the perfect question. Let me try two answers, and then we'll bring on our guest. Immanuel Kant, who, as I've long insisted, explains just about everything when it comes to online digital culture, in the same way that Soren Kierkegaard explains everything about our media ecosystem. I'm only half ironic there. Immanuel Kant made what I think is a really crucial distinction between two different exercises of taste. He says, and this is in his Critique of Judgment, his third great critique, he says there is the taste of sense, the taste of sense. We might even want to call that culinary taste. It is the taste of, I immediately like this thing. It is pleasant to me. There's nothing about it, in other words, that needs to be striven for. You don't have to reach for it. The enjoyment is culinary. The enjoyment is immediate. And for that reason, the taste of sense is individualistic. It is singular. It's that particular mix of the biographical and the inherited and the taught and all those different things. And then Kant says, and then there is the taste of reflection, where my first encounter with something may be prohibitive. I don't hear it. I don't see it. What is there about that that I'm supposed to like? I just don't get it. But for whatever reason, you linger. That reason for lingering may well be the recommendation of someone else that you trust. That recommendation may well be the knowledge that other people have found this rapturous. So is the thing that I'm not seeing, is it because it's not there, or is it because I don't yet have the eyes to appreciate it? And so you sit, and you linger, and you tarry, and maybe you learn, and maybe you research, and maybe you repeat again and again and again. I don't know if I've mentioned, Waleed, but over the last 14 months, I kind of decided I just don't know as much as I want to know about opera. And so I've set myself a task of 4 particular opera, and every week I will re-listen to at least one of them multiple times with the benefit of a libretto, trying to get what is it about this that other people whom I trust, what is it about this that makes it a peculiarly, particularly rapturous, rewarding experience. And immediately, it's prohibitive. It's like a mountain you have to climb. It'd be the same as learning a language for the first time. It'd be the same as discovering a genre of music for the first time and wondering, do I have enough time left in my life really to appreciate this? But you linger with it. And there's something about the particular interaction between the lingering, the time, the effort, the striving, and the achievement, that what you realize you arrived at in the end was something like an encounter with the beautiful. And as Immanuel Kant insisted, it is of the very nature of the beautiful for it to be common, for it to be open to everybody to encounter. And that's where I think this process of you really should, you mightn't like it at first, but you really should try it. And what concerns me about algorithmic recommendations is that they work almost specifically, exclusively, only at the level of the taste of sense. It is, this was pleasant to you, therefore this may be too.
And without the human dimension. So, sorry, that sounds like an obvious thing to say. But if you were to say to me, Scott, I enjoyed this, that comes loaded with a whole series of resonances for me because I know you.
Hmm.
And so it has a deeper meaning than just the mere words that you've uttered there, that I enjoyed this. Whereas from a computer, that's impossible. You have to believe in some kind of mathematical decoding of your wiring to be visible and attainable by the machine in order for that to be meaningful.
Yeah, just on the point of machine learning, I think it even goes deeper than that. There are only certain types of behavior that are legible to machines. There are only certain things that I can do that are readable, that are extractable as data. And what recommendation algorithms do is they rely upon the datification of our behavior. So, for instance, there was a period of time where I turned a recommendation service on in the particular music platform that I tend to listen to. All of my other forms of technology or platforms, I have recommendations off. I only view the things that I subscribe to. That is it. And what I was immediately served up was, okay, you like Chopin, therefore you must like Schumann. And the fact is, I can't stand Schumann. You like Mozart, you must like Haydn. I find Haydn incredibly tedious.
Yeah, but a lot of people have that sort of experience. My algorithm thinks I'm this and I'm not, right? But I think they also have the experience of the more data that's added, the more refined it gets. I take your point more as an axiom, really, than anything I can demonstrate, that there are certain elements of human existence that cannot be reduced to data and then reproduced. in the form of recommendations based on that data. Okay. I want to accept that. I don't know 100% that that's true. One of the points about the gathering of data is that what becomes, if you have enough of it, if the data picture is complete enough, or at least ever more complete, that it's extraordinary the things that you can actually divine from that. And they might be things that we would never have expected mere data to be able to yield. That's kind of one of the points of mass data collection. And in some respects, you'd have to say that, you know, the data machine has shown that it's incredibly powerful and can work very, very well to the extent of manipulating people's emotions or perhaps even how they vote and these sorts of things.
Yeah, but I think what that relies upon there is the coarsening of taste itself. Because one
that
of the,
might be right. So this is the point I wanted to get to. Yeah. Is actually what we're objecting to here, not the quality of recommendations or anything like that, but the flattening or the thinning out of the very concept of taste. So that when you reduce taste to what I like, and I use that phrase in both senses of that, you know, the pre-internet and then the post-social media meaning of that term, right? Like as in things that I find pleasing and like as in things I will click the thumbs up for on a social media site or whatever. When you reduce it to that, you don't have a sense of taste that is something reaching for, I don't know, something more enriching or something that informs you more generally beyond the quite superficial realm of pleasure, perhaps even temporary pleasure.
Or that genuinely surprises you.
Yeah. You mentioned VHSs before, and this thought experiment occurred to me just this morning, actually, which is how much of the stuff that we watch online would we have gone to the trouble of recording on a VHS? Probably, less than a percent?
Yes. Because there was something about the effort.
Right. And what that did was it required a certain commitment to the quality, in inverted commas, the meaning, the significance of that thing that you...
The preservability.
...wanted to preserve. Yeah. Now, because everything's preserved, the barrier to preservation is nothing. Even though you don't own anything anymore, it's all streamed and so it exists in a cloud somewhere, which is another dimension of what it means to own an artifact like a vinyl or a CD or a VHS tape or whatever. But that once everything's immediately and easily accessible, nothing needs to have worth for you to decide this is a thing I want to consume in this moment. This is, I guess, an expression of this idea of infobesity that I might have mentioned once or twice, that all information is more or less equivalent and constantly snackable. And so in that process, you lose any higher order concept of what it means to enjoy it or, to use the vernacular, I'd rather not consume it. So taste, the idea of taste becomes denuded of its grander or richer connotations because the mechanisms by which we are introduced to things, the mechanisms by which taste making has happened, are simply not interested in filling in those richer gaps.
Yeah, that's right. But I think there's also, I mean, I think you're right about the flattening out of taste, but I think there's also something here about the flattening out of culture. Because, for instance, when we have an object that is presented to us, it is usually presented to us with some kind of datafied valuation attached to it. 3,000 people liked this. This received 1,570 positive reviews. And so there's already a kind of, there's a bare weight that is already handed to us. And then that also feeds into the other aspect, of course, of recommendation algorithms, which is the tendency towards massification. You are always directed back towards the mainstream. And the mainstream is quantified by the extent to which it's been engaged with.
Yeah, I'm less persuaded by that. I think actually the opposite might be true of that, and that the old world was more inclined to do that. But you know what? Let's get a guest who can sort us all out. You are listening to The Mindfield on ABC Radio National. Well, Ed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host. Let's get some help, Scott.
We needed a genuine connoisseur of culture, so who better to reach for than Amber Gwynn? She's a lecturer in writing at the University of Queensland and a member of the editorial team in the incredibly stylish Griffith Review. Amber, welcome to the Minefield.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm not sure I'd call myself a connoisseur. I think my tastes are more like, you know, a shower drain where bits and pieces have collected over time, but that's a very flattering welcome. Thank you so much.
But a connoisseur is actually, it now has all these class accretions and connotations to it, but really a connoisseur is someone whose taste is not only trustworthy, but who is also able to articulate the reasons for their enjoyment. So maybe it doesn't necessarily have to have all the class connotations.
I'm kind of interested in that word articulate. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a computational scientist myself, but my background is in linguistics. And something I was thinking about as I was listening to you and Waleed talking was that something that kind of you skimmed across the surface on and circled around was that what underlies these complex algorithmic structures in part is a system of classification. And classification relies on the rather faulty mechanism of human language. So every indexer understands the delicate art, science, and guesswork that comes along with trying to categorize or label things. So this system of categorization, I wonder if it assumes that taste is somehow much more coherent and predictable than maybe it is. And as both of you mentioned, sometimes I just can't put my finger on why I am so drawn to something, why it aligns with my tastes. Now, I'm 41 years old, and I think that Enya is one of the greatest musicians in the world. My husband is a musician. I hope he is not listening to this because he would be absolutely mortified. I think that taste was probably cultivated through childhood road trips where that is what my mother happened to have on compact disc at the time. But I cultivated this taste for what I would call ethereal, Celtic, electronica. They're the words that spring to my mind. But
good.
I wonder what Apple Music or Spotify would extrapolate from those signifiers and how accurate their recommendations would then be. So I was just wondering what relationship you think language has and how we apply it to our tastes, this very wobbly, imperfect and incomplete mechanism that we use to label the world around us, including our own tastes.
What are we referring to there? You're referring to the way we express our feelings about something? You know, I love this, I admire this, and precisely what those words mean in the imprecision.
Yeah,
of those.
Sure.
Or are you
that
talking
because,
about categories?
Like, but
you know,
also,
I like metal. Well, what's metal?
Or yes. I'm talking about both, how we articulate why we enjoy something, but also what categories we'd apply to these aesthetic artifacts, so aesthetic judgments, but also where do they live in the system of cultural creation in that vast ecosystem?
I mean, to some extent, Willie, this has to do, you know, there's genre, and genre is a very old idea. It's a older means of classification, something that emerges, say, more intimately or directly from style. But then when everything has to be classified and everything has to be tagged, I think that's actually the crucial term here.
Yeah, the metadata.
Things have to be tagged in order to be assigned to particular buckets. So this belongs with that group. Whereas I think you're right, Amber, the strange thicket of the sorts of things that we like almost always defy that kind of simple or straightforward classification. They elude the tags that make you think that because these two things are generically proximate to one another, therefore there's some kind of bond of affection that must extend from one to the other. But I do also wonder, you know, tags or genres can also have not just an attractive but also a repellent effect. Mm. I don't like X. Therefore, I won't listen to everything that happens
exactly
to fit within that kind of...
I won't watch that. I won't read that. It's not a category that appeals to me.
I refuse to watch reality TV, so don't tell me that this particular show is a good one.
You never know what you might be missing out on.
Well, I wasn't speaking for myself, although you know what, I actually probably was.
I think this is also where recommendation culture can also go a little bit wrong because we're expecting one thing when the artifact might be something altogether different. I had an experience recently. I love the book Sorrow and Bliss by Meg Mason. I don't know if either of you have read it, but there's a beautiful sister relationship in that book, which I absolutely love. I have a sister, and I love the keen observation and the acerbic wit of that book. There's another novel at the moment that is often being compared to Sorrow and Bliss. It's called Lonely Mouth by Jacqueline Maley. I read it based on the recommendation. If you loved Sorrow and Bliss, you will love this book. And honestly, it took me about a quarter or a third of that book before I could forgive it for not being Sorrow and Bliss and to assess it on its own merits. And I ended up loving that book. But initially, that comparison to Sorrow and Bliss somewhat ruined it for me. And I thought, I suppose they've been compared because they both have sister relationships. There's a bit of wit in there, but otherwise, very different books that should be assessed on their own merits.
Okay, so let me press on this though. Is the problem the mere imprecision of comparison as a concern, like as an activity or an endeavour, or is it the imprecision of the comparison that can over time be improved, refined, as, I don't know, we begin to subcontract everything that's valuable in our lives to artificial intelligence, for example, and it begins to become unbelievably good at whatever it is it's going to be doing? Is there a point at which it manages to distill the formula so perfectly so that all the comparisons are actually just perfect? Or are you saying comparison itself as a way of trying to, I don't know, judge ahead of time what your taste will be on a particular thing is a fool's errand?
That is a really good question and one to which I'm not sure I have an answer. But as you're asking the question, I was thinking about the relationship between algorithmic curation, recommendations, these marketing categories and consumption. You were talking before about the richness of human to human recommendations and those resonances that we share when somebody else has a similar sort of suite of taste to us. And I've been thinking about the things that we have taste in: books, songs, films, plays, visual art, podcasts, increasingly clothes, decor, cosmetics. These are things that we tend to think of as intrinsically human, and we all know that rich value is someone who understands us so implicitly that they're able to recommend things that we might like. And it's not just things that we might like because of every other book or song or TV show we've ever consumed, but it's because they know us. So you might think of the school teacher who's pressed a copy of a book into your hands and how that might have changed your life in some really striking ways. Or you might think of a friend who sends you a meme that they know will absolutely make you laugh, a friend who recommends exactly the tube of lipstick you are after, or maybe there's a film critic you adore and respect and whose tastes seem to align with your own. So we know how seen and validated and understood we feel when someone seems to get us, for lack of a better phrase. And I do wonder what happens when machine learning starts to play a hand in this and makes those opportunities and those choices to engage with media we purportedly like, makes it rather more flattened and soulless. And my thinking is that ultimately part of this soullessness comes from the fact that we know that the purpose of this curation is actually to get us to consume more. And it's the commoditization of culture that actually is what bothers many of us.
That's a really interesting point. So the motivation behind the recommendation is continued consumption.
Yes, just Pac-Manning our way.
Right, that's very different from like maximizing your enrichment or your enjoyment.
Yes, absolutely.
For example, I don't think I've ever done this, but I might say, you have to watch this show or you have to read this book and nothing else for the next month. You've just got to let it sit and it'll do its work. But an algorithm could never make that recommendation because that would run counter to the whole point of the...
Yes, and the algorithm, it wants you to click, it wants you to share.
And move on quickly, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, but there's something else that goes along with that. It's not just, listen to this, don't linger with it, just move on to what's up next. But there's also, if I'm listening, or if I'm reading, or if I'm watching, and it doesn't grab me now, I know that this is not the only game in town. that I've got another thing just waiting for me, one click away, one app away, one screen away. If this doesn't have me now, I can move on to something, and I might come back to it. Waleed, your example of give yourself to this and only this for a month. There's something about that that almost replicates the earlier conditions of cultural scarcity. This was the only movie that was showing at this movie. This was the only VHS that you would rent it out for this weekend.
And it was the only CD my mother had in the car.
Amber, I'm going to have to intervene here and ask you to stop bringing Enya into the conversation.
It's the last you'll hear of Enya.
But I think there's something about the way that recommendation algorithms, okay, they might strive for convenience, for frictionlessness, but what they actually do is they create also a kind of behavior that accommodates itself to that, not just the expectation of frictionlessness, but also the impatience with something that I really have to strive for.
Yes, that swipe leftification of engagement.
Can I just point out, I realized that with some of the examples that I gave, this is kind of what it might feel like. I'm not talking about high culture, believe it or not. There are certain things that, you know, it's not in the realms of literature or European auteur cinema. There are certain things that, in order to be worthwhile, in order to find that which is beautiful in and of them, they simply have to be stuck with. One of my favorite, I mean, we could get into a whole Indiana Jones conversation here, but I'm going to spare you all that. One of my favorite genres of films are these incredibly sappy, almost slapstick romantic comedies of the late 1940s and early 1950s. Anything involving Jimmy Stewart and Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn, I'm a sucker for. I'm there. I mean, part of it, there's something a little bit nostalgic about that for me. It's also the sense of humor that I tend to like. But there was also a process of watching and rewatching and rewatching that allowed you to see things and to grasp things and to grasp a depth of human emotion and of tenderness and fragility and of restoration and forgiveness that I simply wouldn't have observed had I simply watched that once and then moved directly on to, I don't know, whatever was next up, like Gone with the Wind. So we aren't just talking about the high reaches of high culture. There is a benefit, I think, in limiting certain forms of consumption, of cutting oneself off from the recommendations and to almost impose upon oneself a kind of condition of artificial scarcity where you limit yourself and try to find the depths, try to find the beauty. And I think more than that, try to find the words to then be able to put around, this is why it is that I love what I love.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, too, there must be a temporal quality to taste. My research centers on the ways that people choose and use books, and so many of my research participants have told me it was simply the wrong time for me to engage with that media, something that didn't speak to me 5 years ago. 5 years onwards, it was on my shelf, it seemed to be looking at me, and it was just the right time to engage with that book. And I think you have to be able to return to culture and to art multiple times too, and each interaction will inevitably be different.
Wow. By the way, you are listening to The Mindfield on Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. That voice you hear there belongs to Amber Gwynn, lecturer in writing at the University of Queensland and editor of Griffith Review. Amber, can I come back to your point about language?
Yes.
Because as you were saying that and in the subsequent discussion, I've just been turning it over in my mind. Which model of recommendation, if that's what we're doing here, talking about, which model is it a bigger problem for? Is it a bigger problem for data-led recommendation, so algorithmic recommendation, or a bigger problem for traditional forms of recommendation that actually relied quite heavily on articulacy, that relied on finding the words to explain why it is that you like X or why it is that it's worthy of your attention? Because I could see an argument either way, right? I could see the argument that, well, the data relies really on nothing but these words and perhaps papers over the ambiguity of what those words might mean and the categories we use and so on. And, you know, perhaps that could be refined over time, but that is still a problem. But the other one is just all articulation and,
yeah,
and all words. So I don't know that focusing on the linguistic indeterminacy of things tells you necessarily which mode of recommendation does a better service.
When I think about it, I see both angles too, and I'm not sure I could characterize one as a necessarily bigger or smaller problem than the other, but perhaps problems that have different results or outcomes down the line.
Right.
And I suppose I'm someone thinking constantly about what, you know, the machinery, the apparatus behind all of this data accumulation, what's happening with that data, where will it end up? And I'm a bit cynical, I suppose. I cannot stop thinking about the consumption angle when it comes to algorithmic curation and what large language models are doing with all of this data that they're collecting about our tastes. So it's probably not the problem you were thinking of, but the problem I'm thinking of is what ends up happening with all of that data. What is the purpose of it? What is it driving us towards? And I'm not sure it's really driving us towards deeper engagement with culture or expanding our tastes. I suspect perhaps it's exactly the opposite.
No, I'm with you on that. You're right. That's not what I was thinking of, but yeah, I share that. Yeah, absolutely.
Can I put something to the two of you, though? Taste has always had a kind of class dimension to it. You know, Bourdieu put it quite beautifully. Taste classifies, but also those who have taste are classified. If you have these tastes, this is the strata to which you belong. And if you are upwardly mobile, or if you want to kind of taste your way or enculturate your way out of certain confines, this is the way to do it.
But he also said that class tastifies.
Class tastifies.
Words.
Yes. No. That's exactly right. Class enculturates. I've long been worried about the way that taste and, say, unacknowledged tastes can produce a degree of shame. So, Waleed, you mentioned before guilty pleasures. These might be kind of a little bit transgressive, but, you know, not really that bad. There are certain things where it's just kind of, it would be embarrassing to acknowledge this is actually something that I enjoy without then the endless series of qualifications. I know I shouldn't, or I know I'm watching it ironically, or I kind of watched it because of the spectacle and not because of the substance. Mm. But there is something about fully embracing what it is that we love. And then I don't think you have to find reasons for everything. I'm not sure there are reasons for everything. There are causes for everything. I'm not sure there's a reason for everything. But embracing the full range of what it is that we kind of enjoy and then trying to work out, both acknowledging that publicly, but also trying to work out, what is it then that kind of knits these things together that simply thought of in terms of class or in terms of education or experience, they don't quite go together. But I know for sure that permitting shame to keep them apart in my mind and in my kind of public presentation, I know that shame is probably not getting me anywhere.
I was actually hoping that you would circle back to class. When we were first tossing ideas back and forth, you were talking about trying to extract class from the culture equation. And I thought that was an interesting approach. Can you boil culture down that way without class being one of the ingredients that gets boiled out? I don't think we can avoid the question of class when we're talking about taste and culture and algorithmic curation, because these algorithms, to go back to the large language models, they're based on huge, huge data sets. And we know from emerging research that those databases, those huge data sets, they reveal biases that privilege particular worldviews, particular varieties of media, particular classes, particular tastes. So one of my concerns is not just the homogenization of taste that we're talking about and what we lose when we don't make space for the unexpected, but also whose taste we're privileging or preferring and why, and what's being left out as the digital increasingly tempers our tastes.
In that case, I think it's time to confront this point. Surely that was a much stronger critique of traditional forms of recommendation than of digital ones.
That's right.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's a good point.
The thing of digital recommendation, actually, is that it pushes us towards alterity, and it pushes us towards ever more polarized content, because that's what is driving engagement. This is not a new critique. It's obviously not my own critique. This is widely understood now. These are things that taste makers in human form would never have licensed. And if you want to run a class critique, it would go, well, those taste makers are members of the middle class, or perhaps the ruling class, or whatever it is you want to say. And so they reflect those sort of tastes. I think what flows from that is, well, who's to say that's all to the bad if the alternative is kind of what we're seeing, and if the mechanism to deliver the alternative is such that what you get is not really taste, but something that is far more thinned out than that and far more anemic. I don't know. I'm sensitive to... I think class has vanished far too much from our public contemplation.
That's right.
But I'm also a little wary of following it all the way down as a way of then assessing the,
sure,
the value of things.
I do wonder, will we always be at the mercy of some cultural gatekeeper or another, whether it's human or non-human?
Look, maybe two very brief points to cap this off. I mean, you're right, Waleed, that these kinds of recommendation algorithms do direct us towards alterity, but only a particular type of alterity, a certain type of alterity that does benefit from certain criteria of engagement, of reaction and interaction. In other words, the values, the sense of value that recommendation algorithms has is not inherent, but is only measured in terms of the sorts of things that machines can measure. So it's not the value of
And the
of
companies
alterity.
That own those machines want to measure.
Yes, that's exactly right. But look, there is something about taste that is incredibly personal. I don't want to say private. It is singular to who we are. One of my concerns about moral language, about certain forms of political commitment, and about certain expressions of taste is that they are designed to be worn. They are designed to be performed, in other words. You don't just like something, you have to let everyone know that you like something. In which case, if we want to get down into the authenticity rabbit hole, we certainly can. I think that in order for taste to be taste, it actually has to be felt. There has to be something about it that does, in fact, touch one, that expresses itself in a form of value that resonates deeply with oneself, that it resonates with that which in the object is beautiful or good or worthwhile or profound or insightful, and that there's something about that connection that then reproduces the good and the beautiful and the insightful within us. What I think I would probably want to move away from a little bit is taste as ostentatiousness, taste as simply performative, taste as that which has to be on display for others to see, and as a way of boosting or burnishing my own aesthetic or cultural bona fides. I think what articulacy about why it is that we love what we love, it holds together the different contradictions in what it is that we like. But it tries to find that in it, which is truly humane, which is, to go back to your point, Waleed, worth preserving, even if no one else was around to share it with you. And so there, it's actually the performative or the egotistical dimension of taste that I think could probably do with being taken down a few pegs.
And that reminds me, there's a wonderful media studies scholar named Ted Streifus, who talks about delegating the work of culture to algorithms. And it's not the word delegating that I keep thinking about, it's actually the word work. And what you've just described there is a form of effort, labor, work, the work of engaging with culture, and that's what I'd hope we don't lose sight of.
Amber, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Amber Gwynn, lecturer in writing at the University of Queensland, editor at Griffith Review, our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield, which is now at an end. See you next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.